Welcome back to Question Medicine 2020. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal by now. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. And we are going to wrap up, finish up, put a close on part three, the top articles of 2019. And then with that, we move on. We move on to the newer articles. Now, not all the newer articles are going to be from 2020, but they will be either important articles I thought about, read about, and just haven't got to from 2019, or they will be from 2020. We'll move on to new articles after this podcast. And if you don't like hearing about what I think the top articles are from 2020, well, then I would tell you to skip this podcast and return next week, or you know, sometime in the next week or two when the next podcast is released. Like I said before, there's a bunch of new things coming in 2020 that I haven't revealed yet. This has all just been the normal old question medicine that you're used to, but there will be new question medicine, new a new style, new format, a new sound effects, just new stuff coming here shortly after this one, but we can't do that until we finish where we're at right now. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Andrew Bill, Question Medicine 2020, part three. This is going to be the last part. Now, after part number two, the better brain said, I like when you talk about patients. It helps me connect it a little bit better. Unfortunately, these next two articles, I don't know if I can really talk about a patient. It is about flow. Flow, you know, from Progressive, she's going to save you a whole bunch of money on your car insurance, your homeowner's insurance. Flow, but she wants to talk about her relatives. Yes, her relatives. And who are her relatives? Who are those relatives that I speak of? Of course, I mean the Flozins, canagliflozin and dapagliflozin. And there were two studies in 2019 that I think need to be discussed. The first article is canagliflozin and renal outcomes in type 2 diabetes and nephropathy. This comes in the New England Journal of Medicine. And this study randomized just over 4,000 type 2 diabetics with albuminuric chronic kidney disease to either 100 milligrams of canagliflozin or placebo. Now, you might be saying to yourself, Andrew, wait just a second. This whole canagliflozin, I remember this drug. This canagliflozin is an SGLT2 inhibitor that back in 2017 was in the CANVAS trial. That's the one that had this increased risk of amputation. Yep, that's it. I remember canagliflozin. And I would agree with you, except in that particular trial, it was up to 300 milligrams of canagliflozin. And yes, I would agree. There was increased risk of amputation. There is no doubt. But that was not seen in this trial. So maybe there's something special about 100 milligrams versus 300 milligrams. But just know that if you go to use this trial in your own clinical practice, it is 100 milligrams. Or if you go to use this drug based on this trial, it is 100 milligrams. Now, these individuals mainly all had chronic kidney disease stage 3. The median follow-up was 2.6 years, and they looked at the primary composite outcome of end-stage renal disease, doubling of the serum creatinine, or renal or cardiovascular death. This is super important. Those are four really hard endpoints. I mean, think about your patient that you have sitting in front of you that has chronic kidney disease stage 3. Maybe they have, I don't know, a creatinine of 1.4, 1.5. How long does it take for them to either A, end up on dialysis, or B, have a doubling of their serum creatinine level? This is an impressive composite outcome. Normally, like most diabetic drugs, they do things like how soon till you're on dialysis, how soon till you have a doubling of creatinine, how soon till you go blind from out of control diabetes, and how soon do you have a rise in your A1C of 0.5 or a decrease in your A1C of 0.4 or some other mythical number that means absolutely nothing because it's a surrogate endpoint that we don't really know what it means in the real primary patient-oriented outcome overall, but it at least gives us, and us meaning the individuals running the trial, something they can hang their hat on so eventually they can publish this study. Because after all, it is the publish or perish mentality in most of medicine these days that really drives home a lot of the publications that we see. But not in this one. 2.6 years of follow-up, and they did death, renal or cardiovascular, doubling of the creatinine, and end-stage renal disease. How soon does the patient need to rent a chair 3 days a week because they're on dialysis? These were everyday patients that we see in our normal practice. They averaged about 15 years of diabetes from the time they were enrolled in the trial. About two-thirds were on insulin and over half were on metformin, which begs the question of why wasn't everyone on metformin since a majority of everyone was a CKD3 or above. So I wish that it was everyone, but that's neither here nor there. Let's get to the results. There was a 30% lower relative risk for the primary composite outcome. If you translate that into numbers needed to treat, the number needed to treat was between 22 and 25, depending on which outcome you were looking at. That means 22 to 25 individuals need to be treated for 2.5 years to prevent one primary event. And means to prevent one renal, cardiovascular death, one end-stage renal disease, or one doubling of the creatinine. I understand that death and doubling the creatinine are not the same, but in 2.5 years, to have even one of those four events prevented out of every 22 to 25 individuals is still very impressive. And that's why I think that it is one of the top articles of 2019. Now, when I first read this trial, I thought this was an obvious take-home. I mean, come on. You're giving diabetics a diabetic drug. You're giving them medication to better control their A1C, and we all know that diabetics that have uncontrolled A1Cs are likely to have a worsening of their renal function. So it only makes sense intuitively in my brain that if you better control the A1C in a diabetic, you would then save or preserve their renal function, and that must be how the drug worked. Obviously, we just had better control of their blood sugar during the trial. This was a no-brainer, except for when I looked at it, there was a 0.25% difference in the A1C at the end of the trial. Not a 2.5 difference in the A1C, a 0.25 difference in the A1C. Now, I'll grant you that is definitely statistically significant. Clinically, though, a difference of 0.25 in the A1C, I don't think makes one bit of difference, one iota, not even sniff a difference. And I would challenge you to find someone, anyone out there that thinks that a 0.25% difference in the A1C is clinically significant at all. And if you find them, you let me know, because you've probably found the only person in the world that actually thinks so. This was sort of deflating, at least for me, because I thought, well, okay, it's not the A1C, so what is it? I know these SGLT2 inhibitors, they work in the kidney and they block glucose reabsorption back into the body. So then you're peeing out glucose. With glucose goes volume. With volume goes blood pressure. So it must be, the only thing I could really figure here is it must be that patients that are on these medications obviously have a lower blood pressure because they're peeing out the glucose and the fluid and then their lower blood pressure. And we all know that hypertensive renal dysfunction is a real thing. It's a real disease. And those individuals that do not have good control over their blood pressure, well, they're going to have worse renal disease. So if we give a medication that lowers your hypertension, well, then we should just have better control over your renal dysfunction. That makes sense to me. Except for when I looked at the data and it turns out that in the end, there wasn't much of a difference in the millimeters of mercury. Not much at all, about 2 millimeters of mercury difference between those that were treated with canagliflozin and those that were treated with placebo. I will tell you, 2 millimeters of mercury is a difference. There is no doubt. It's a difference for sure, except for it's not much of a difference. I wouldn't say it's clinically relevant. I would say statistically relevant, but not clinically relevant. Now, this can only mean one thing, or at least potentially only mean one thing, and that, of course, is that maybe with no change in the A1C and no change in the blood pressure, or at least not a clinical change in either one of those, maybe, just maybe, these flozins are people drugs and not diabetic drugs. These medications are meant for individuals, humans, everyone. and not just those individuals with diabetes, which of course leads me to my next trial, which is dapagliflozin in patients with heart failure and reduced ejection fraction. This was a phase 3 placebo-controlled trial that randomly assigned just over 4,700 patients with heart failure and an ejection fraction less than 40% to either dapagliflozin or placebo. The primary outcome was a composite of worsening heart failure, which was defined as hospitalization or urgent visit that required IV therapy for heart failure, or cardiovascular death. The median follow-up was 18 months. Think about what I just said. Death or going to the hospital for heart failure, what's the difference over 18 months? In these individuals with a mean ejection fraction of 31% over 18 months, well, the primary outcome occurred in 16% of those in the dapagliflozin group and 21% of those in the placebo group over 18 months. OMG. And if you broke it down by the individual composite, well, then heart failure hospitalizations in the dapagliflozin group was 10% and 13.5% in the placebo group, which is a number needed to treat of 27. And if you were looking at death from cardiovascular causes, well, it was about 9.5% in the dapagliflozin group and 11.5% for the placebo group. We're looking at numbers needed to treat right around 50. This was amazing. But remember, I said in order to get into the trial, you had to have heart failure, a reduced ejection fraction, anything less than 40%. And the amazing thing is, when you looked at the individual data, the results were consistent on whether the individuals had or did not have diabetes. This is game changing, because maybe, just maybe, these medications are not diabetic medications. Maybe they're people medications. And there are certainly more trials underway, but this was the first one. And I want you to remember where you heard it, because in the future, we might be heading towards a time when the flozins are no longer just for those individuals with diabetes, but rather for all individuals. Now, I have one more paper, and then I will do a major summary on all the articles from 2019 that I reviewed, all the articles that I think are the top of 2019, and we'll end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. But before I get to the last article, I want to tell you a secret. It's a secret I don't tell many individuals, but it is a secret I'm going to tell you, the Questioning Medicine audience. And that is, every individual I know, every individual I've ever met, and every adult that I've ever come across has one inherently common thing about them. And that is, they themselves, they know someone, or they're related to someone who suffers from hypertension. It is an undeniable truth that if you are alive, if you are breathing, not only should you be screened for HIV according to the new USPSTF guidelines, you should also, or you do, or you suffer from yourself, hypertension. Which takes me to the last article of 2019 that I think is oh so important. It is titled, Bedtime Hypertension Treatment Improves Cardiovascular Risk Reduction. This was in the European Heart Journal, and it was an amazing trial because it took almost 20,000 patients, roughly 10,000 patients in one arm, 10,000 patients in the other arm, and they split them up. In the two groups, here's what they did. They said, you 10,000 people, you will put your blood pressure medication at bedside. You will take your blood pressure pills every single night before you go to bed. You 10,000 people, or almost 10,000 people, you will put your blood pressure medication at bedside. You will take your blood pressure medication every single morning upon awakening. And then we will follow you over about 6 years and we will see what happens. We will have an outcome. The primary outcome was primary cardiovascular disease endpoint, a composite of cardiovascular death, coronary revascularization, heart failure, myocardial infarction, and stroke. And then we just wait and see. We don't add any new drugs. In fact, the providers could prescribe any drug that they wanted to. It did not matter. The only stipulation, the only request from the trialist was, if you can, please try to make it so there are no BID drugs available. I mean, there is almost not an indication in the world in which you can only use, or you almost have to necessarily 100% use a BID drug. You can almost always supplement it or exchange it for a drug that is a once daily dosing drug. That was the only recommendation. The rest of the time, you could do whatever you wanted. They didn't care. Any drug, any calcium channel blocker, any ACE inhibitor, any ARB, any, it didn't matter. Beta block, well, you name it. It didn't matter. You just did what you already do. The patient just took the medication at a different time. And in the end, something absolutely amazing happened. There was a 45% relative risk reduction with zero cost. So we calculated the absolute risk reduction, it'd be around 5 to 10, which makes a number needed to treat of 15, depending on the event you were looking at. If you did a cost-effectiveness strategy, if you calculated what is the cost-benefit here, well, it would have to be infinity because it didn't cost anything more. There were no new drugs. It was already just doing what the doctors already were doing. Now, this was open label in nature, and the patients knew what they were randomized to because you can't randomize this sort of trial. I mean, you could say, keep these pills, which ended up being placebo, and these pills that were the real thing by your bedside. Now, only take these at night and only take these during the morning. But then what if the patient got them confused and took the wrong ones at the wrong time? You can't do that. You can't do that. But the nice thing about their outcomes was that their outcomes were hard endpoints. Outcomes were seen in every single outcome they look at. Their outcomes, things like stroke, well, it's hard to fake a stroke. I don't care who you are, it is hard to fake a stroke. Their outcomes like a myocardial infarction, again, it's hard to fake myocardial infarction. Their outcomes like cardiovascular death, well, it's hard to fake a cardiovascular death. I mean, it just either is or it isn't. So some individuals I know have told me, I don't believe the results of this study. Maybe, okay, I could tell you that maybe they do this study again and then it's not exactly the same. But we were getting 40 to 45% benefit. So even if you think that this study is a total flub and we're only getting half of what they say because I know so and I am really smart. Well, that's fine. Go ahead. Still, we're getting a 20 to 25% relative reduction. We're still looking at numbers needed to treat way under 50. The number needed to treat for aspirin in secondary prevention is right around 55. And none of us would think twice before ever prescribing aspirin to anyone who's had a heart attack or anyone that has had a stroke. And yet, if you question this, you're questioning something that is so solid that even if we take half the effect of it, we're still getting numbers better than we are aspirin for secondary prevention. I think this is real. It may not be the end-all be-all. We might run another trial and show, it turns out that we didn't get quite the benefit. But when you're seeing such large benefits at this baseline, I borderline believe it would be unethical to run another large trial when we know that the first trial had such a huge effect. Whew! Let's wrap this up and then let's take it home and end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. Here we go, counting down from the very first article on part one until the very end. Number 10, get an automated office blood pressure reading. That one-time nurse slap-on, wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, that is no good anymore. We need the machines. You hit the button, you walk out of the room, it gives you an average of all of the blood pressures taken, not just the one time. Number 9, subclinical hypothyroidism. Don't treat with a TSH that is less than 20 if the free T4 is normal. If the TSH is greater than 20, well, then the guideline does not apply. The guideline also does not apply for those individuals who are pregnant or trying to become pregnant or those individuals less than 30 years old. Number 8, vitamin D treatment has not been proven for patient-oriented outcomes, period. End of story. There should almost come a time in the very near future, maybe in 2020, where the number of vitamin D levels that we order routinely or check on or the number of vitamin D prescriptions that are prescribed levels off to around maybe just 20 prescriptions in 2020 for all of the world. Number 7, sports concussions and subthreshold aerobic exercise for return to play. I think it is here. It is real. 80% of baseline for 20 minutes on a bike or a treadmill. Long gone are the days that we say, sit in a dark room and don't do anything, just like we used to do with back pain. We had it wrong for a while. We're getting it right now. Number 6, asthma guidelines. Out with the Saba, in with a PRN ICS formoterol. In the United States, the only ICS formoterol that you can possibly order is Budesonide for Motorol. It's the only one available in the United States. Number five. NOACs are now first line. Warfarin is second line for AFib. And there is no longer aspirin as a recommendation for anticoagulation in atrial fibrillation. The only time that warfarin is first line therapy, the only time it's first line therapy is moderate to severe valvular stenosis. Which valve, you ask? Mitral valve. Only the mitral valve. Number four, 80% of total knee replacements will last 25 years, and 60% of hip replacements will last 25 years. Number three, everyone should be screened for HIV. Everyone, everyone, everyone. And yes, that means everyone. Also, if those individuals are high risk, then you need to have a discussion with them about pre-exposure prophylaxis, PrEP. Yep, antiretroviral therapy for HIV. Individuals who are at risk are those that do drugs and share needles. Men or women that have sex that have a partner with HIV, men or women that have sex that have inconsistent condom use and have an unknown HIV status of their partner, or men or women that have sex that have had a positive syphilis or gonorrhea test in the last 6 months, with a caveat being that men who have sex with men, it is the last 6 months with syphilis, gonorrhea, and chlamydia. Men who have sex with men, caveat, the extra there is chlamydia. Number two. Over-the-counter hormonal contraception is coming sometime at a pharmacy near you. I'm not sure when, but every organization, yes, every organization, no matter what organization you're in, should be screaming this from the mountaintops. Number one, Flozins. Canagliflozin seems to improve renal outcomes in type 2 diabetes, and dapagliflozin decreases heart failure hospitalizations in everyone. And the numero uno, it's not even number one, it's number zero. It's so important, it's before you get out of the blocks. If you listen to nothing else, it would be this last line. Take your blood pressure pills at night prior to going to bed. A 40 to 45% reduction in almost every outcome we looked at, which included things like heart attack, stroke, death, cardiovascular disease. This was huge. And with that, I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Until next time, keep the quest in question.